As we started to push over, about 20 or 30 Japs jumped us. And it started the dogfight that spread all over the sky, and maybe 10 miles by 10 miles or something like that. And Japs got on my tail, and then I went into this cloud to get away from the Jap on my tail, and came back out, and here was a Zero right in front of me.
Today, we'll hear from Lieutenant Colonel Henry Mayo Hank Bourgeois. Bourgeois served in World War II as a Marine Corps fighter pilot and was a member of the Black Sheep Squadron. The Black Sheep became famous for their numerous successes over the Solomon Islands and their leader, Lieutenant Colonel Gregory Pappy Boyington. Hank Bourgeois joined the Marine Corps on September 1st, 1941, his 20th birthday.
The war hadn't started yet, and at that time, the flight training course to become get your wings and become an officer was about 18 to 20 months. When the war started, they cut out all the crap, and we went down. I was out of there in June, 6 months, and I got my wings. And went to the Marine Corps as a second lieutenant. We went out to North Island, California, by San Diego, for fighter training, and finished that about the 1st of December, 1942, and then they put us on a Lurline, a transport right to the New Caledonia, and from there up to Espiritu Santo's New Hebrides group. And I joined VMF 122 when I arrived there in late January 1943. And that was my first combat tour. And we were on Guadalcanal with flying F-4F Wildcats. And we didn't have too many airplanes, and the experienced pilots got all the combat flights. But the only thing I did was we had a photographic Wildcat, an F-4F-7, I believe. And I flew two or three missions over Munda to take photographs. And a couple of times the airplane was riddled. And the only other mission I can remember, and that was a strafing mission when the Navy damaged, I think it was a destroyer in the straits there, and we went up to strafe it. The second combat tour was interesting because we got brand new, not brand new, but we got 18 Corsairs. And that was a great airplane. And I'll never forget the first time sitting in the cockpit with a handbook, reading it, and then it says, you know, push this switch, push that switch, push that button. And you know, the mechanics there, he didn't see this airplane before either. And then that big engine started to run. God, it was a thrill. Had about maybe 6 or 7 hours in that airplane. And the Japs were, from their submarines, were launching seaplanes at night to fly reconnaissance flight over the the harbor there in Espiritu Santos. So they asked for a volunteer to go up and try and shoot this thing down. So being young and enthused, I said, I'll go. And so I took off one night at dark, and they're trying to vector me around with the radar. And they'd get me under this thing. And it was a dark night, you couldn't see it, but I could see them against the stars, but I couldn't slow down. It flew so slow, you know, I kept passing under it, and that vectored me around and came back. I never did get a chance to shoot at it. But that was a thrill in my first mission in a Corsair. We were escorting SBD dive bombers up to Bougainville. If I remember, there were about 18 dive bombers, and I think we had 16 Corsairs in the air flying cover for the dive bombers. And we got up there, was a big thunderstorm. They were really after the shipping, and there was a big thunderstorm over the harbor, so the alternate was to hit the airfield. And as we dive bombers started to push over, about 20 or 30 Japs jumped us. And it started the dogfight that, you know, dogfights spread all over the sky, and maybe 10 miles by 10 miles or something like that. And the Japs got on my tail. Lundeen, Captain Lundeen, was my leader. And he went after a Jap, and a Jap went after me. And then we got separated. And then I went into this cloud to get away from the Jap on my tail, and came back out, and here was a Zero right in front of me. I mean, you know, maybe 100 yards at the most, just sitting there. I blasted him, and he blew up, and then I went back into the cloud because they were after me again. And this went on, I don't know for how long, but it was in and out of this cloud, and after, you know, I shot two Zeros down that day. I came out, and there was nobody around. There wasn't an airplane in the sky. And so I returned to base. And that was my first combat mission, where air-to-air, actually, somebody was shooting at me, and I'm shooting at them. The first Corsairs we got were the F-4U-1s, and that's before they screwed them up with extra armor and all that bit. They were powerful, they were lightweight, they had problems with oil leaks and hydraulic leaks, but I have about 350 hours in Corsairs, and I could get in a Corsair right now today and fly it. The early models were unbelievably maneuverable. You could bank and turn and pull hard things, climb fast, they'd go fast. And you know, who I really praise is the mechanics on the ground. We'd come back from missions, and they work all night long, getting these airplanes ready to go in the morning. They might exchange wings or tails, or put a new engine, a carburetor, magneto, or what it was. But I never had a bad airplane. It's kind of interesting. There's a picture in that book over there, a side number, Corsair 13 on Monday. I seem to have flown that Corsair side number 13 most of the times. You can see it has a bunch of holes of it, and I was a Rhinobacker that shot up in that airplane. But that airplane always seemed to be a little faster, a little smoother, a little better trimmed than all the rest of the airplanes. And you know, it's hard to explain. It's like racing cars, I guess. Some are great, some are not so great. We usually had about 18 airplanes assigned at one time. And you had 24 pilots, or 26, whatever it was. And you rarely had more than 16 airplanes in commission. Some of them were on the ground, you know, waiting parts or whatever it was. And Frank Walton would assign the airplanes, you know, and assign your airplane number 22, 13, or 7, or whatever it happened to be. And that's the airplane you flew that day. But you didn't, nobody had an airplane assigned to him specifically. I've read some articles where people, like Walsh, I believe, claims that he had his Corsair all the time. Whether he did or not, hard to believe. But we didn't. We flew whatever was available. Zero, you know, we were briefed early that it was a, you know, fast, maneuverable airplane, and that you just didn't get involved in a dogfight where you're trying to outturn him because there's no way you could do it. You'd always try and keep speed and dive away if he was on your tail, but it had one vulnerability. It had no self-sealing gas tanks or armor plate. And if you could get a burst of fire into that airplane, it was going to go down. John Bolt, he got interested in armament, how you load the rounds in a machine gun, and he came up with, I can't remember, like an incendiary armor piercing, a tracer, and something or other. It was a brand new concept. And he spent a lot of time with the ordnance people, making sure the guns were all zeroed in at about 200 yards or whatever it was. And I tell you, when you hit a Japanese Zero or any airplane with 650 caliber machine guns, that is a lot of firepower, because, man, they fire so fast. The airplane would explode. You'd knock the wing off or tail off or kill the pilot. I guess my attitude and the people in my flight was, kill the bastards. We talked about, do you shoot them in a parachute? I couldn't do that. But as long as you hit the airplane, knocked them down, got the pilot out, everybody was happy. But I know there were some people that, shot at them in a parachute, in the water, things like that. But there was some tragedies. Bill Case in one mission in VMF 122, we were escorting B-24s, and some unexpected Corsairs came in to join the escort, and he didn't know there were Corsairs, and he just pulled over and fired at one. Fortunately, it didn't do any real damage other than some holes in the airplane. But then we lost Alexander in VMF 214 when he mistakenly shot at one of our PT boats, and they shot back and knocked him down. And there was another mission where my division was assigned to strafe some Japanese island bases that were really deserted, but lousy weather coming back, and the last man in the division saw what looked like a barge going through the water, and he just pulled off and started strafing it, but it was ours. You make mistakes. I joined VMF 122 when I arrived there in late January 1943, and that was my first combat tour. And I flew two combat tours with VMF 122, and then that squadron was rotated home. You had to have, in those days, three combat tours, and then you were eligible to go home. And I was in a pool of pilots, and at that time, Boyington was designated to be the commanding officer of newly designated 214. And he went through the pool, and he picked out pilots who had combat experience. And since I'd had two combat tours and had shot down some Japs, I was one of the people that he picked. And that's how I became a member of VMF 214, the Black Sheep.
When you were assigned to 214, what were your initial impressions of Major Boyington? Had you heard about him before?
Well, when I went over to the islands, he was a senior officer on the transport. I first met him just before Christmas 1943, and there was always parties, and Boyington was there. I didn't know who he was at the time. He was just introduced as Greg, and that was the first time I met him. And then when we were transferred to go overseas, it turned out that he was the senior officer in the pilot replacement pool aboard the ship. And that's when I first got to know him, because he liked to play bridge and I liked to play bridge. And so it was 17 or 18 days getting over to New Caledonia. So we played a lot of bridge on the way. He had brought along a case of Scotch whiskey for some general friend out there, but I think he drank it all up on the way. So, and that's when I liked him, But when we got on the islands out there, he seemed to do a lot of drinking, and he really was not an administrator on the ground. Whatever squadron was in, it was really run by either executive officer or some administrative officer. And In the Black Sheep Squadron, it was Frank Walton, who was intelligence officer, and he really ran the ground part of the squadron. And Boynton just seemed to, you know, be kind of placid and drunk most of the time. Sometimes when he took off in the morning, he just staggered out an airplane. But in the air, God, I'll tell you, it was something. I can remember flying dawn patrols with him, and you would go up there, and it was really nothing to do but just circle around for 2 hours and hoping if the Japanese came down to you know, bomb Munder, you might get something. And it was nothing to do, so he'd get bored with making circles, and we'd start doing loops and rolls and over wing overs and anything else just to. And it, God, by the time he ended up, he was sweating like mad trying to keep up with him. But he was a brilliant pilot, very aggressive in anything he did on the ground, hand-to-hand fight or anything like that. On the Lurling going over, there was a Marine Raider Battalion being transferred out to the Pacific. And every day up on the recreation deck, they would practice hand-to-hand fighting and boxing and everything, and he was right in the middle of it all the time. His opponent was a corporal or sergeant or another major, it didn't make any difference. He'd do his best to beat him to the ground. He just seemed to have a will to win in everything, on the ground, you know, fighting, arguing, or in the air with an airplane. And he certainly, in the airplane field, was extremely capable pilot. You know, he was really something. It's kind of interesting, that combat tour, we never, even though we supposedly had a division, you know, I was a division leader, being an experienced combat pilot, and I had a wingman, Bill Heyer, and then two other wing, second section, and that's the way we went up. And but when we get up there, you never had enough airplanes, and you'd get a mission in the morning or a mission. We usually flew two missions a day, you'd go on. Frank Walton would say, "Hey, look, you're going to fly this, you're going to fly that," and Boynton. I had a reputation for having extremely good eyesight, which I did in those days. And Boynton was anxious to find Japs to shoot down, because sometimes we'd go up on fighter missions and sweeps, and there wouldn't be a Japanese in the air. So one day he says, "Bourgeois, you are leading the mission today." And he was flying on my wing. And we went up, and that's the way he was. You know, he was aggressive, and he wanted to get into some sort of action. And that day, we went up there, and we were right over Bougainville area. And I'm looking up, and there are two Japs way up high, and there are two Japs way down low. And I told the leader of the other division, I said, "You take the two up there, and I'll take the two down there." And we rolled over. We never could catch these two guys. They went into a cloud and disappeared. And when we got back, Boynton chewed my fanny out. He says, "Why didn't you just stay there and let them come at us so we could get them?" But that's the way he was. He was really aggressive. When you get in combat with people, you're depending upon each other. They're your friends. I mean, I don't think there was anybody that did anything, you know, like robbed a bank or chased girls, because there's no girls out there. But you become a, it's hard to explain. I guess it's like a football team that works together, and they develop a comradeship where they want to win, they want to do well. And in VMF 2-122 and 214, it was the same way. But it seemed to be more so in 214. And I attribute that to we had about three or four singers that every night, you know, after the flying was over, the doctor would give us a couple of brandies, and you'd sit around and sing. And And some of these guys are pretty good. You sit around close and working together, it's kind of impressive. When a squadron was organized and we all knew we were going to be assigned to VMF 214, we got together and talked and we ought to have a squadron name. And Frank Walton encouraged that. And the guy says, why don't we call ourselves Boeington's Bastards? And Walton says, no. He says, the papers will not put that in their papers back home. You got to think about something else. So they argued about it for a while, and they decided it was Boeington's Black Sheep. Which the bastard stripe with the type thing. They had finally asked an artist, he was a Marine correspondent, I believe, to draw up a shield with the bastard stripe and the rest of the thing. So that's how, it was accepted, and it's been that way ever since. I was only there in the first combat tour, okay? That was from September about 6 to October, whenever we finished the first combat tour. And I don't remember any correspondence or any, big deal. At that time, Frank Walton, and I didn't know this, was sending all kinds of press releases back to the United States, everybody's hometown. In fact, he sent them to the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. And when I came home, I was a hero, and I didn't even know what was going on. So he did that to everybody, and I think that stirred up interest in Boeington, because he began, his first mission, he shot down five Zeros and then got a few more and began to build, his lead, his quantity, as it is. And Walton, would always enter that in every press release. So, and I think that stirred the interest of correspondents. And when the squadron went back for its second combat tour, then that's when they hounded him up there. The day Boeington got his five, I was in that mess. I shot at things, but I really didn't do anything. It was another big melee. But one thing that came out of that, when the fight broke up, and you scattered all over, you don't know where you are, and I'm heading back to Monday, and all of a sudden tracers came by my airplane. I'm looking in the rear view mirror, and there's a Zero back there. So I wasn't going too fast, but I throttled and everything forward, full throttle and everything, and this Zero was closing up on me. And he's shooting, but didn't hit the airplane. So one of the things you do in a Corsair to get away from a Zero is you dive, because you can outspeed him. So I dove down on the deck, and this guy stayed right with me. Make this airplane go fast. You close all the flaps, the cooling flaps and the oil flaps and everything else, and he's still sneaking up on me. Every once in a while, he'd lob in some cannon shells or whatever it was. And I realized I wasn't headed back towards my base. I was going at an angle away for it, and I'm getting kind of low on gas. I decided, I'm going to have to fight this guy. So I'm ready to turn around and do whatever I can, and all of a sudden, the Zero pulls off and flies away. In 1973, after I'd retired from the Marine Corps, I was working for the Singer Company in one of the aerospace divisions, and they sent me to Japan to help one of the Mitsubishi divisions that was producing our gyros and things to plan for the future. Their vice president of marketing was a retired Japanese Air Force General Suo, and we got to talking about the war, and he and I became friendly because he likes to hunt and I like to hunt. And in fact, he got me a custom-made shotgun while I was there, which was impossible for somebody to do. So we talked about the war, and he'd been invited back to the United States, to New Jersey, to view our factory and how we did things. And I said, bring me a logbook and I'll check my logbook. And we went back, we looked at a logbook, and that was a guy that day that was trying to shoot me down. And it was interesting. We became lifelong friends. I took him duck and goose hunting in Maryland on the Eastern Shore. And that night we went to dinner, and I'd been picking up the tabs all the time. So he picked up the tab, and we had a few snorts. And dinner was over, he turned to me and he says, Hank, son, he says, you know, I'm sure glad I didn't shoot you down.
In 1976, a popular television series was produced, loosely based on Pappy Boyington's book. And members of the squadron continued to gather at reunions for decades after World War II.
Out of the 54 in the first into the two combat tours, we're getting down to a few. In fact, I wonder who's going to fly the last mission. I hope it's me.
That was Lieutenant Colonel Henry Mayo, Hank Bourgeois. Warriors in Their Own Words is our attempt to present an unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. Thank you for watching, and by doing so, honoring those who've served. This program was produced by Evergreen Podcasts and Documentary.tv. I'm your host, Ken Harbaugh. If you've enjoyed this episode, please comment, share, and subscribe below.